I'm sure some of you might wonder why we even have this topic, because obviously Billy Graham is the best-known Protestant clergyman in the world. I suppose we'd have to say that the Pope is the best-known Catholic clergyman in the world, but certainly Graham is the best-known Protestant clergyman in the world. He preaches the gospel, and he brings sinners to a new life in Christ. And shouldn't, you know, many people would say, shouldn't that about sum it up? Shouldn't that, be enough? And why talk about anybody who's have been able to sustain such a remarkable ministry for such a long period of time, really over 30 years? And we could let it go at that. Certainly no other revivalist preacher in all of American history has had such a long and remarkable career, even though he suffers really from several physical ailments. But nevertheless, he has become, I think, the most eloquent spokesman for the position he represents in all of Christian history. Now, granted, in the terms of, headcount, that no other revivalist preacher before him had radio or television, so it's not really fair to compare, in terms of numbers with the other people, but still, the record really speaks for itself. Now, in the presentation tonight, I don't mean in any way to minimize the great achievement that is his. And when you add to that things, for instance, such as the fact that the Grahams have sacrificed virtually any kind of private life themselves, other than the time they spend at home in their retreat in North Carolina. Graham can't eat in a restaurant, he can't walk down the streets, he can't do many of the things we do, because he's simply mobbed by well-wishers or sometimes by people in the other school. But nevertheless, I think it is in order, since he is a public figure, and the record there is for everybody, that we should make an assessment by asking, let me do that by asking four or five questions about his ministry, and then invite your response with this. And right from the very beginning, I think with Graham we face an enormous task, because it is the fact that to some people the kind of ministry that he provides is exactly what they want, which is very meaningful for them. And on the other hand, there are those who maintain that he represents an older and outmoded system of theological ideas and evangelistic practices. So, with the controversy already in mind, let me start with this specific kind of question. What is it? And let me try to answer it, obviously. This is a rhetorical question. It isn't like the first time I had freshmen this year. It was so funny. I wasn't used to freshmen, and I asked rhetorical questions, and they started answering. I just wasn't ready for it. They were so eager and ready to go, and by the time you get to be juniors and seniors, they're much too sophisticated, and blasé to pay any attention. But freshmen, answering, I just cracked up completely. I still see Greg Peterson over there answering rhetorical. Anyway, let's stay with this. Now, rhetorically here, what makes him so popular with them? All right. I think to answer that, first of all, we have to ask, we have to give the answer that many people do, that Graham is popular because he is essentially a product of our times. That is to say, he is the product, really, if this is one answer for it, that he is the product of several forces at work in society which roughly coincided in about the year 1949, 1950, and later on I'll explain why that date's important. But a lot of forces which came together at about 1950 and have lasted until this time. And there are those who say with Graham that if these forces hadn't existed, and if they hadn't all sort of come together in a kind of mosaic, that Graham himself would never have become so influential. And and for evidence, for that, we can say, we can give this, that right after World War II, the United States, you remember, got involved in the Cold War with Russia, which seems to be heating up again, right? But this was starting in 1945, 46. And that Americans, this is, the one argument, that Americans needed reassurance that, they were doing God's will, that God was on their side in the battle against communism, and Graham was preaching that. And therefore, people argued that we should support him because he was preaching that America was closer to doing God's will, obviously, than the Soviets were. We're way with this, on this, all right. Or at the same time, you can argue, besides sort of the fact that he sort of surfaced at the time the Cold War was at its peak, he also surfaced at a time when the mass media, especially television and widespread radio, came into its own, larger than any other time in American history. All right. And television especially, because it's pictorial. And if this isn't clear, just please get after me on this. television because it is pictorial and not just, you know, not just something that you hear, but you see at the same time. Television thrives, as we well know, on scenes which show strong emotions, which show people in sort of, you know, life-making decision kind of situations. There is real feeling, there is real emotion, and that attracts a wide audience. Because for the most part, it seems, you know, far away from the ordinary humdrum kind of activities of our daily life. And so therefore, some people have argued that he's popular because the kind of revivals which he conduct are appealing because of the appeal of television itself. If you watch the Graham revivals, you know that the cameras zero in on faces, on individual faces. They're trying to make it, for one thing, obviously, and it's quite proper, they're trying to make it personal. They just don't have, you know, they're not going to have one camera sitting at the top, you know, panning back and forth like this, but they have several cameras, and they zoom in on faces to make it more personal, because if you see a, you know, an audience of 50, 60,000, it does get to be a little bit, you know, abstract and impersonal. But sometimes those faces are in showing very deep, you know, and critical emotions, and I think that's another explanation that people make for his popularity. All right, a third explanation, besides the fact that he was preaching against the Soviets and the fact that he came on with the popularity of television, a third reason is that people admire the kind of person that he is. And I want to draw here from his most recent biography, and it's a marvelous book, and they've ordered it here. Marshall Frady, who is a combination political-religious biographer, has written a biography called Billy Graham, and then subtitled A Parable in Righteousness. And I think that's really a clue, because what Frady says is that Graham represents a type of person, if you like, a cluster of what we would call character traits, which we want to believe is still strong, or are still strong, in America today. That is, Frady says, and he says this over and over again, that Graham is really so very wholesome, dedicated, straightforward, unsophisticated in his own life, and that's the kind of person, you know, that many of us would like to, you know, be ourselves, or that we admire in people and, you know, in high places. And that Graham represents the kind of values which attract people. We know, for instance, that in almost all cases where there are mass movements, when you get, you know, large numbers of people following in a certain direction, that in large part it's because they are attracted to a very dynamic, powerful, not in the Pentecostal sense, but in the other sense of the word, you know, charismatic kind of leader. Not in the charismatic sense that we talked about, you remember, about in January when we had those Thursday morning or those early morning sessions. That is, a person joins a movement because he or she finds that the leader personifies the ideals and the values of the movement. They find these ideals like righteousness and dedication and straightforwardness, unsophistication, you know, sort of missing in their own life, and therefore by identifying, you see, vicariously with the leader, in a very real sense, these deficiencies are made up, you know, in their own life. All right. Now, or let me put that another way. I used a lot of big words there. One thing I think that helps explain Graham's popularity is that since American life is changing so rapidly, for instance, the amount of information that we have doubles every 10 years or so, we want to hold fast to something which is permanent, something which gives our lives meaning and direction, and not to be pulled off in so many different directions, so many different, you know, fads that come up. I talked, what was it, about a month ago about cults. And there are so many of these which are popular today, and many people just simply want something a little bit more stable than all these new trends and fads and so on. And therefore, what happens is that they find in a strong, powerful leader such as Graham himself, the kind of stability and order and meaning which they can't find anywhere else. And therefore, since he offers a traditional message which goes, you know, straight down the line, and which, for, you know, there's no mistaking what it is, obviously it has, you know, a great deal of appeal for it. All right. And that really leads into what I think is the fourth reason for his popularity, and that's something I've virtually touched on already. That, I think, is that he stands for a combination of very traditional, familiar theology in our country, and for a very sort of strict moral code of ethics. All of which seem to be coming loose, you know, in our country today. And therefore, when Graham is preaching the kind of things that many people want to see happen in this country, obviously they are, you know, they are supporting it, and they're willing to do that for them. All right. So therefore, Graham, I think, because I think he's popular because he got started just at the time when communism was coming into its own. as a direct threat to American life because of the appeal of television, because of the sort of the dynamics of a mass movement, and because he says this kind of things that many people want to hear from their national leaders today. Or to sum this all up, as Frady, his biographer, says, that he embodies a certain kind of righteousness. So he really is the kind of person that we see on television, and that's very reassuring for, you know, for a large number of people. All right. Now, that I think is one part. I think another question that has to be raised here, and I'll just throw it out and see what you think of it, is that I think there's no question, but at least another explanation for his popularity is that his organization, the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association, the BGEA, if I refer to it that way, it's just, if you, it's, that's what I mean, the BGEA, Billy Graham Evangelistic Association. Sometimes it's called, you know, the Hour of Decision, if you know his radio program, and so on. But if I refer to BGEA, it's just, that's just because I've got it down in my notes that way. All right. Some people say that he has succeeded because the BGEA is so well organized. It uses the most sophisticated means of advertising, of organization, of promotion. And given the kind of combination of talents and influence that the promotion part of the revival represents, there's no way in which he could miss being a success with this. And there are those who say that there develops a real danger here because the association itself is so big, so large, that it tends to sometimes overlook some of the very real needs that the people who answer the altar prayer call, the people who come forward, really are crying out for. I would only submit that if you're ever in Minneapolis, the best way to answer this question is, you know, to go for yourself to the association office. It's right downtown on 1300 Hennepin. You can't. It's right there. In fact, it's amazing. I didn't realize this until I was there, that the Graham Association is the largest single. I'll put it this way: it gets more mail than any other single, agency in the Twin Cities. It has its own zip code number. You can't beat that. Not even Pillsbury or 3M or anybody else have their own zip code. But they get enormous amounts of mail, and you can go in there, and what you'll see is how, for instance, how proud the people are of their operations, the enormously sophisticated and up-to-date machinery, and all the rest, and how dynamic, sort of the atmosphere of the whole place is with this. But while the Graham people are proud of this, there are others, I'm suggesting here, who say that all this becomes too smooth, too slick, that it is run as a business, really, while the evangelists, they argue, should be given to more simple, sort of one-to-one kinds of, activities with this. And others argue, in the same line, that what is happening is that the Graham Association from the very beginning has placed a great deal of emphasis on numbers. That is, if you want to, you can find out from the Graham Association the total number of people who have been to every rally since Graham became famous in 1949, how many decisions were made, how many people answered the altar call, how many of these people who answered the altar call had not been baptized before, for instance, who hadn't been church members before. And the impression that many people get is that Graham is preoccupied, or the association is preoccupied, you see, with numbers. Now, Graham answers that. He's had this argument made every time he's had a press conference. And Graham answered that by saying, yes, there are all these numbers, and if only one person is converted, he argues, in all the programs that the association has had, if only one program over all this time has been converted, then all the effort is worth it. You only sort of need one sort of to justify the whole thing. This would be, Graham's answer for these. All right, now, another criticism that's made in line with the fact that this is a very smooth, well-organized operation is that they say that the rallies, the meetings that we see on television, are very carefully staged. The critics argue that they are manipulative, that they rely on the knowledge that we have of how to motivate people by doing something through various kinds of techniques, by the hymns, the soft lights, the other kinds of things that are put forward. If you remember at a Billy Graham, crusade, there's sort of a level of behavior which is very clear. You've never heard or seen anything untoward or unnecessary, anybody shouting or any, unruly behavior at a Graham crusade. And there are those students of mass behavior who say that because of various techniques, which the Grand people know very well, they simply are able to create an atmosphere, you know, of respectability and all the rest of these things, which overshadows, you know, the sort of the message itself. With us, I can only give one reply to that, and then something that I saw myself in 1969. There was a famous rally in the Twins Park in Minneapolis. Well, I can't say Minneapolis. St. Paul always gets mad when you put the Twins Stadium in Minneapolis in Bloomington, and Graham had what 45,000 people there, and there were at that time we used to call them, you remember, hippies, and they came in, you know, without shoes and all the rest of the thing. And wanted to sit down in front because all the other seats were taken. They came just at the last minute, and two ushers in, you know, white suits, not white suits, but white shirts and tie and all the rest of these things, came and were going to take them out because you didn't want this kind of image, and there was going to be national television and all the rest covering this sort of thing. And Graham saw what happened and just came out himself and said, you know, let them sit there. Which was kind of a remarkable kind of thing, because I'm sure most of the crowd in 1969 wasn't sympathetic towards young people without shoes and long hair and, you know, and what we call original, you know, clothes, you know, styles and all the rest, whether they were, whatever you want to call it, with this. All right. Now, there were others, of course, who also, and this is one of my own arguments that I put forward, and I think it's valid, who argue that sometimes Graham appeals in the wrong way. For instance, I remember the first time I heard him was 1950. I was trying to impress a girl, and she trying to, you know, and so she invited me to go to a Billy Graham revival, and I thought, well, if that's one way to impress Donna Mae Simonson, that's the way I'll do it. And I wasn't really all that interested at the beginning, but I got sort of completely carried up in the thing. And Graham said, you know, come forward tonight, answer the altar call tonight, because you might have a car accident on the way home and you might be dead and it's been too late. That, you know, is a little heavy. That really is. But anyway, we didn't have a car accident, obviously, with this, but that's another criticism that's made. All right, now, a third kind of general criticism that's made. And this is one which I'll take up in a little different sense in the next time I do one of these evening sessions, is that Graham, along with other radio and television preachers, you see, are taking money away from the local congregations, that they have, in a very real sense, created their own sort of extra, or what we would call para-church, with this. That today, for instance, if you've watched, or maybe in the last 3 or 4 years, there's been a rise of the thing we call the electronic church. I want to talk about this whenever we get on the schedule again. With the PTL club, praise the Lord, some people say pass the loot, but anyway, you know, he's gone from nothing to, that's Baker, Jim Baker? It's Pat Robertson on 700 Club, and Jim Baker, right, on PTL. People that love is what it comes down to, but he's gone from nothing to $25 million a year in, you know, about 3-4 years. Or there's Jimmy Swaggart, there's Jerry Falwell, there's Robert Schuller, there's Rex Humbard, you know, there's Oral Roberts, all of these people, you know, and way up in the $40 to $50 million you know, a year budget. All right. Now, what they argue is that Graham, in a sense, along with these other people in the electronic church, have created a new church or a new denomination which take away people's resources and energies, you see, from the local congregation. They argue that the local congregations are hurting enough for financial support and simply can't compete with something so powerful as the Graham Association has, because it has such remarkable ways, really, of raising funds. Let me give you a marvelous example. Once a year, I like to talk to the Northfield Retired Ministers. That's an association there, and a lot of the old Norwegian ministers like to come back to Northfield as a sort of the last hunting ground. Isn't it? Elephants know where to go back to die. They go to a certain place. I shouldn't be so blunt, but you know, you die in the shadow of the hill and all that sort of thing. And anyway, they come there, and well, they come because there are a lot of other men and they can associate with them. And I was talking about Billy Graham to the Northfield ministers. And one of them, and during the comment period, had a wonderful thing, and I'll quote him here. He said, I don't want to do the Norwegian accent, but he said, yes, some of us work hard in the fields for years and years, and then in a twinkling of an eye, someone else comes along and reaps all the harvest. In other words, he had done all the preparation, all the education, the background, what we call the nurture in the church, and somebody takes a bus from the congregation up to a Billy Graham rally at Twin Stadium or something, and suddenly decides that now after that they're a Christian, and they hadn't, you know, really seen the light before. And local ministers sometimes, you know, aren't really that enthused about that sort of thing. All right. Now, Graham would answer that by saying that his kind of ministry is only one kind, a very specialized ministry, and he would call it a very narrow form of ministry. And that he's not trying to do anything like competing with a local congregation. He's not trying to set up, you know, a side association. But what he's trying to do, obviously, is to get people to, you know, make the first step with this. And it is true with the Graham Association, if you follow this, that for those who go forward, they do get a referral card. And they're asked to fill out the referral card to state what kind of denomination they consider themselves or might want to join, or what kind of organizational, you know, preference they have. And after a rally, and the Graham Association always works with a local ministerial association, after he won't come into a city unless he has virtually 100% endorsement from the local Protestant Ministers Association. And he just won't do it. I mean, there have been cities where he's been wanted, but there's been sort of division among the ministers, and so he just, you know, he won't come with us. But anyway, the referral cards, after the people who answer the altar call come forward, they fill out the referral cards, and these then are sent to the appropriate places, you know, in the local congregations. And then it's up to the local congregations, you know, to make the effort to get in touch with these people in one way or another and try to bring them, you know, in the church. And what Graham says then is that his ministry is simply to launch people towards participation in the churches. And after that is done, he says the future of the person who answers the altar call is in the hands of the local congregation. With this, all right. Anyway, that would be the criticism there. The only thing that I would say personally is that what oftentimes can happen, and we have, you know, some records on this, is that people come forward at an altar call, and it's a very, you know, tremendously moving, stirring kind of experience. And if this is sort of their, in a very real sense, their introduction to the Christian faith, what happens when they, you know, after being on the mountaintop, when they have to sort of go back into the valley again? Do they have enough sort of nurture and strength and education to be able to carry on in the ordinary, dull, you know, oftentimes frequently frustrating life of the local parish? You know, this is, I think, a very real problem. I remember myself having had a couple of sort of mountaintop or peak experiences after, you know, going off to things like the National Lutheran Students Association meeting, and then coming back to good old First Evangelical Lutheran Church in Kenyon, Minnesota, where they were arguing about whether or not to put up a flagpole, you know, for an American flag, after I had heard, and some of you who were here before heard, knew Dave Wee, and it was Dave's father, Maury, who was the leading speaker at the NSA or the LSA meeting before, and he was just one of the great figures. He was here at Thanksgiving too, wasn't he, Biv? And Craig, I think, yeah. And you know what a tremendous guy he is. With this, and then having to come back, you know, to Kenyon, Minnesota was, you know, culture shock, I suppose you could call it, or something else like this. All right. With this, all right. Now, another question that comes up is that Graham, and this is not only my opinion, but that of others, that Graham sometimes, I think, provides what you might call, especially in the television programs, he provides some role models which oftentimes really aren't too appropriate. That is, oftentimes that when he's on television, he has the testimonials or the witnesses, you know, of famous public officials, or of, you know, one more Miss America, or famous athletes, or political figures, or people successful in the business world. You know, the ones who come forward, with a couple of exceptions, and I'll mention that in a minute, the ones who come forward to, you know, to give a little 2 or 3 or 5 minute witness, and I'm not minimizing that at all. I mean, people are completely sincere and honest, and it's, you know, everything like that. But that they are always successful, they're always attractive, you know, they're always well-known. Have you ever seen a homely singer, you know, on any one of these things? You know, never. It's they're just not there. It's always somebody who, you know, looks like Linda Ronstadt or something with this. All right. Everybody seems so wholesome, so nice, so attractive, you know, with this. And this lasted in the Graham Association until the time of Watergate, when Nixon himself, I mean, Graham, obviously I'm getting to Nixon, you know, really got burned, because Graham was so, you know, enthusiastic about getting, you know, national figures on television to make their witness that he didn't realize that Nixon was using him, that Nixon was simply exploiting, you know, the reputation. There was a famous time, it was in 71 or 70, when Graham was giving a rally at the University of Tennessee football field, is that's either, I guess that's in Knoxville, it doesn't matter, but anyway, and you know, all these thousands and thousands of people there, and the first two people who came on just as the program started were, you know, Billy and Ruth Graham, and then, you know, Richard and Pat Nixon came, you know, right with them, and obviously the identification on national television with a political figure with Graham obviously gave great credence, you see, to Nixon's whole image, public image, and we know how preoccupied he was with that, and he couldn't, and Graham could never, you know, Graham could never cope with the fact that Nixon turned out to be something less, you know, than you know, the greatest president we've ever had, and probably he will never have his likeness, you know, on Mount Rushmore. With some of the others, and he was burned, and he's been careful about that ever since. And I think there are signs, good signs, in the other direction. Some of you know the paraplegic Jeannie Erickson. I think, does that ring? You know, Jeannie Erickson. She draws and writes with her mouth, and she has no arms or legs and everything. And Graham has had her on the program. And some people don't like to see, you know, handicapped people or paraplegics or anything else, and because, you know, it isn't nice and everything else. And Graham has had her on, and she does a marvelous job with a witness. It's just a sparkling radiance that comes forward with her, that it's an amazing thing to see. And I didn't get an answer, but I wrote them back, and, you know, the Graham Association said, you know, keep this up, instead of having one more Miss USA or one more, you know, Super Bowl hero or something like that. We just don't benefit from that anymore. All right, with this, all right. Anyway, the question comes down, really, I think the last question that I'd like to raise is this, is mass evangelism really the best way, you know, sort of to present the what we would call the Christian way? What it leads to in mass evangelism, just to sort of to follow up on that question, obviously, is that Graham preaches on certain Christian ideas, certain Christian teachings and doctrines, but he avoids those which are controversial. He doesn't talk on baptism because Christians are divided on baptism, you know, total immersion versus sprinkling, or infant baptism versus adult baptism. He doesn't talk on the Lord's Supper, on that sort of thing. And what I'm suggesting that has happened here is that he sets up a situation where those who come forward oftentimes aren't really ready for the kind of controversy and the clamor which they find within a community itself, a religious community itself. If they are told that this is the Christian faith and they come forward and there's no controversy, they should have been here the last 2 days, you know, and so on. Still sort of reverberating myself, the vibes I still feel, but anyway, if they aren't ready for that, they may well simply give up on the Christian faith when they find out that it isn't, you know, answering altar calls, you know, all the time with this. Now, in other words, people are saying that sometimes Graham oversimplifies. All right, now, it's only fair to give Graham's answer, obviously, to that. Graham answers a charge of oversimplification this way. He says that when a person is sinking, you know, going down in whatever it might, you know, for whatever problem it might be, alcohol or whatever it might be, sense of guilt and sin and all that sort of thing. You know, when a person is sinking and that person is thrown a lifeline, that person doesn't ask where that lifeline comes from, or that person doesn't try to figure out whether or not that lifeline is made out of hemp or nylon or fiberglass or whatever else it is, but that person grabs on, you know, and is saved. When you're sinking, you don't ask where it comes from, you grab on and save it. And Graham points to the fact, he said, that there are believers, you see, who have lost their faith by too much thinking, by too much analysis. And therefore, once the over-analytic mind sets in, obviously the sort of the simple childlike faith that's talked about in the New Testament, according to Graham, really, is lost. Now, there's more things I could say, but I've talked probably a little bit too long with this. I'm not suggesting in any way that you know, that there should be any kind of public attempt to stir up opposition to Graham. I mean, this is a country with, you know, complete religious freedom and everything, and there's no question that he has made an indelible, permanent mark on Christianity itself. I just sort of throw open some of these kind of questions for any comments, you know, that you want to make. Okay. Well, that's not bad. Half an hour. What do you think? I don't believe in, you know, drum roll, timpani, you know, mask, you know, or Wagner opera kind of conclusions.
You know, with watch this, to see some TV?
I watch them all, every one. Channel, now they're back, since Channel 11 has gone the other way, it's Channel 9 now, and I watch them all, I'm totally hooked. Watch every one, yeah. They're usually about every other month.
What is it that hooks you?
I like, how do I say it? Maybe it's just, I don't know, thank you, Kevin, for asking me that. I know what's, you know, in a one sense what's happening, and there is something about the excitement of a revival that's very appealing. And, you know, I might as well say to everybody, you know, sometimes you can say things at Holden that you can't see any other place. Oftentimes, I'll say this straight out, I wonder if there isn't something wrong because I've never answered an altar call.
I was just going to ask you if you ever did.
No, I never have. And maybe I'm always flirting. Maybe, you know, I'm always on the edge. Maybe, you know, maybe Donna Mae was right that I should have, you know, come forward because she went down that night, I remember, and I didn't. And so on. Maybe that's, you know, the sort of thing. Let me give an illustration.
And Erasmus understood all the issues of the Reformation and what was wrong with the Catholic Church. And, you know, he understood the Bible and all these things just as well as Luther did. But he never left the Church. He always stayed sort of within the fold of the Church, even though he was critical of the Catholic Church. And Luther likened him, and any of you who grew up on a farm would appreciate this, he likened Erasmus to a cow who sees greener grass in the next pasture, and you open the gate, but the cow doesn't move out of the pasture where it is in the first place. The cow just sort of stands there and looks all the time without moving on to the next, you know, to the next pasture. And, you know, there are people like that who are always looking. That's one thing, Kevin, with and then Graham always has some interesting things really to say about national events and everything else. And really, to his credit, and John, who wanted to be sure I knew this before I gave this presentation tonight, last summer he came out very strongly against escalating arms race. He came out very strongly against spending more money for armaments. Now, that's the first time in his, you know, in his career that he's done that, but he sounded like something straight out of Sojourner's magazine up here. And that was kind of a surprise. Because at the beginning, like in the early 50s, he was very much what we would call in the Cold War warrior kind of extent. But I think, yeah, I don't know what it is, I just sort of feel more comfortable when I'm listening to religious services or something. I don't know, but you know, I suppose some psychologist would have some explanation for it, but I don't worry about that. Graham is, you know, enormous influence, I mean, there's no question. That he said, I don't myself personally, I don't disagree with, but let's just put it that way. I think conversion is something that can happen by, you know, instant decision. But I think there's another way, and this is something I've written a book on that Augsburg's going to bring out next year, that you can get to conversion, if you want to put it that way, you can get to faith through slow, steady, what we call nurture, too. And not just the instant, you know, and not just the instant conversion approach. And and Graham says in his last book, How to Be Born Again, which just came out last year, that everybody has a historic moment in their lives in which they made a decision for faith. They might not be aware of it, but there was a moment when it happened. And he states that straight out. And I don't want to get too heavy into the theology here, but he also says that once you've made that conversion experience headed, and you know what it is, you take on what he calls a new nature. You're able, in a very real sense, he argues, to cope with, you know, sin and evil and all these things in your world, you know, to a much greater degree than before that there was a case. Now, Catholic and Anglican and Lutheran theology don't teach that. They say, you know, you're just as much a sinner the day until the time you die as, you know, as you were at any other time in your life. So I would disagree there, yeah.
Do they say grandfathers or do people...
No.
So
that's no, I see what you're saying. Oh.
No, all these letters to Graham, but it just seems like it's
yeah.
Followers.
What? Yeah, that's a very real. I think that's really almost the crux of the thing. Because there's no question, but that where Graham has been able to get people into congregations, who weren't there before, he's showing them what the Christian way is all about, because you need the nurture and the strength and the support, really, of a congregation. At least I think almost all Christians do, and that's fine. But what happens, what oftentimes happens, is that because he is so famous and he is such a good speaker, that people invariably, and a lot of ministers have told me this, a lot of people invariably keep comparing their local pastor to Graham, and guess who comes out second best? Who is it? They're not polished platform performers. They don't have the aura of being a celebrity. Sometimes the sermons are pretty bad. We've all heard bad sermons, and that creates a problem for some people, because they say that. And the real one is Graham, and what most ministers would like is for the congregation to come and tell them what they don't like about what's going on in the parish. This is I don't know how many I've led a lot of retreats for ministers on weekends and stuff, and that's the thing that they say they would like to be told directly by their parishioners what's wrong or what the parishioners don't like. And a lot of parishioners are afraid of doing that because they say that creates controversy and tension and heart, bad feeling and everything else. And you'll never get a problem resolved unless they do. And so in other words, what happens, and I'm sure many of you have been in congregations where this has happened, they sit back and just sort of snipe away at the minister, or worry about the length of the hemline of the minister's wife, or other major issues go along. And pretty soon the minister's, lost, what you might call the leadership or the respect of the congregation. But I digress a little. John, I thought you were going to.
I just came.
Sure.
How did you and Oral Roberts get along?
Oh, yeah.
Is that worth discussing, or
sure.
Stick with?
No, Graham, fine. Roberts, just very briefly, Roberts came out of the old traditional classical Pentecostal tradition, Pentecostal Holiness Church. And what had happened was that he had some kind of lung congestion, wasn't it, I think, when he was a teenager, and the doctors had given up on him, and they came and laid hands on him, and obviously he lived, and he considered that to be a healing from the Holy Spirit, and his ministry just took off from there. And he joined that. I was coming to that. And his early success, especially in the 50s, was through the faith healing thing. Because there just weren't other faith healing, ministers, and that's pretty, pretty heavy stuff on the truth. That really is.
Did you hear his brother on 60 Minutes talk about him?
No, I'd love to. I usually watch it, but was that
the last time
you were out? I haven't seen television since end of the year. That's just like Billy Cuddy, but anyway. My feeling, I sometimes, maybe tonight, or maybe it'd be better for another time, I'd like very much to do the whole thing on healing and faith healing and everything. I think that, because we've had some great sessions here. I remember in the summer of 78, none of you, with Emily, remember Emily and I did those things on healing that were just terrific. I'll just finish then whatever, And then what happened was that there was a lot of criticism because if he continued in his ministry, it looked as though he was trying to get to be more respectable because he joined the Methodist Church and, not in the old, quote, Holy Roller kind of tradition. And then he started Oral Roberts University, which some people thought was sort of a monument or a temple to himself, just like Schuller's Church in Garden Grove. I think, I would put him in one sense in the same way with Graham, that if you can lead people into, daily discipleship, whatever you want to call it in the church, fine. But if it gets to be a matter of staying home Sunday morning and watching Oral Roberts in a nice comfortable chair with your coffee cup and all the rest there and thinking, you're really doing a lot by sending in your check there and not supporting the local congregation where, there's so much to be done, then I think, there's a real temptation, a real danger there.
Where does the money go?
For Bill
Graham, I know he's got movies and
not Graham himself. For one reason or another, his number one business director drives a Cadillac, which is terrible PR, really. Drive a brand new Chevy or something. You can get a pretty nice Chevy. But the Cadillac thing always comes up. But Graham himself only takes a salary, I think, of something like $32,000, which really, in his category, is not excessive at all. I mean, really. and has to cover a lot of personal things from that.
Is that for sure, or is that?
Yeah, no, his books are audited. One thing he is aware of and he got a lot of criticism for was early in the 50s, he was just getting started, he was just, about 31, 32 years old and just getting started. He would have what they would call offerings of love gifts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you would just send it in and they wouldn't report, well, they don't have to report to IRS, but they, there wasn't very careful use of, or careful tracking, I should say, of the funds. And pretty soon when he made it big, his first really big appearance was a major revival in New York in the spring of 1957. Madison Square Garden, right?
Right, I
yeah.
read that.
Yeah, and when he made it to the Big Apple, then obviously, the real critics and the really tough ones, the Woodwards and Bernsteins and those kind of reporters were there waiting. They had to shape up, and their books are open now for any responsible CPA to see. They made one mistake. Yeah, I want to answer Lisa's question directly. They made one mistake. They had a slush fund of $23 million in reserve, and they didn't report it. They didn't. And this was about 2 years ago, and it really got in a lot of it really got them in a lot of trouble, and rightfully so. And right now, some of the money goes to missionaries, but most of it goes right back into more movies, more television, tracts, sermons. You can get the weekly sermon if you write to all you have to do is write to Billy Graham, Minneapolis. And as somebody put it, Minneapolis, Minnesota, somebody didn't hear very well. And they've got that envelope in the Billy Graham Association office. And it got to his office, it got there somehow. But in Minneapolis, but anyway. Another place that has gone, and I was there this fall for a conference, is at Wheaton College, and they just put up a huge library at Wheaton, the Billy Graham Study Center or something else like this. And we were down there for a conference, and I was really excited because he was supposed to come himself, but then he got sick or something at the very end. So I wanted to go up and tell him a couple of things first.
Mm-hmm.
But never, and I like celebrities. Yeah.
What's his background?
Okay. His father was a dairy farmer in rural, obviously rural. If you're a dairy farmer, you're not in the city. His father was a dairy farmer in North Carolina. And Billy grew up on a dairy farm and had no special signs of greatness in his youth. Grady shows, and he got this information from Graham himself, that Graham really liked girls in his teen government. I mean, really liked girls. And there's some interviews with some of the girls that he used to date, and it's really fascinating stuff. And they talk about, what they remember about Graham, with it. And Graham's not afraid of letting this come out on the public record. With it. And they have, and it's so different than around, maybe not right here, but from the part of the country I am, in the South where he grew up, obviously, they have annual revivals right at the end of, for the harvest season. This is just a normal sort of thing. When the harvest is done, there's time, for fellowship and give everybody together. You have revival with everything else. And he was 17 years old, and there was a fairly well-known revivalist by the name of Mordecai Ham, who was in town. I forget. It was near Montreal, yeah. And Graham answered the altar call when he was 17 years old, and still to that day, to this day, is convinced that that was a turning point, and decided that he wanted to be a minister. And he would go off, and he wanted to be a preacher, and he would go out and preach to the stumps out in the woods when he was still, a teenager, getting his technique and all that perfected. And then he tried, this is fascinating, he had to go to school, some kind of college, a Bible college, and so the first he tried Bob Jones University, and of course that's that's the whole story in itself. Bob Jones, where the couples aren't allowed to hold hands, and they have to have a chaperone, and they literally have barbed wire and no blacks, and anyway, he tried that, and he to his credit, from my standpoint, he thought that Bob Jones was too strict, and he dropped out, and then he tried a little Bible college somewhere, was it Lakeland, Florida, something, Florida Bible College or something. And then father got sick and he had to go home and work for a while. And then finally got going again and he went to Wheaton College in Illinois, over Wheaton, right west of Chicago. Mm-hmm. And not very far. And then graduated from Wheaton in 41 and wanted to join the military when the war came, but he had some kind of physical disability, I forget which it was. So he got involved in what became his real sort of first stepping stone, Youth for Christ. And Youth for Christ got started in Chicago, preaching to the young people. And he just took off because, well, he was handsome and he was, exciting and all these things, and just sort of, you know, moved right up from that point on.
Is that what Young Life came out of?
Young Life came out of there too, right, yeah. Yeah.
You were saying a while ago that 1949,
1950 was significant. Yeah. Oh, wonderful story. I've got this, and I've got the sermon. He was doing well in youth circles in the 40s, but not, you know, he wasn't big. And this shows the power of the media, it's just incredible. And he was preaching in Los Angeles, which is not a hotbed, really, in spite of all the jokes I make, for great revivalists. And it's usually called a cemetery because, you know, it's so big. I mean, you know, it depends on if you're received as well as your showbiz razzmatazz is. And you have to be an Amy Sample McPherson, for instance, to survive in Los Angeles. And she was the one who come on the road. She would have a sort of a mezzanine, and she, you know, for her services, she would come in a flowing white robe, but she'd be riding a motorcycle. You know, you can't beat that. But anyway, for an entrance, you know, and so on. Yeah. Oh, you just. But anyway, Graham was in Los Angeles, and it started in September of 49, and just at that time, it was announced that Russia had detonated its first atomic bomb. And that was big news. I remember that vividly. I was in college. Boom. Boom. That's the wrong metaphor. But anyway, remember it very well. And Graham, one night, said, and I've got the documentation and all this, he said that the Russians have 3 atomic bombs. And one is scheduled for New York, one is scheduled for Chicago, and one is scheduled for Los Angeles. And that got, you know, that got the crowd, you know, pretty worked up. And if you want to call it, you know, the act of God, fine. If you want to call it, you know, just sheer chance, fine. But what happened that night, when he announced about these 3 atomic bombs, one of the housemaids of, you know, America's biggest newspaper publisher, William Hearst, I'm trying to think, I forgot his.
Randolph
Hearst, yeah. William Randolph Hearst's maid, one of his maids, was at the revival meeting. And she went home and told Hearst what she had heard. And the next day, you know, Hearst knows a good story, you know, when he sees it. That's just why he was so great. And he sent a 2-word telegram to all his reporters. And it's journalistic jargon. It said, "Puff Graham." In other words, give Graham the full treatment. Puff, you know, build Puff Graham. And that's gotten to be a famous thing. In fact, in the Graham headquarters, they've got the telegram itself, just as an example. Because the Graham people would say, you know, that was God acting and giving him the publicity that took off. And Hearst gave him, you know, full publicity. Young, energetic, good-looking, the kind of this thing I was talking about here, the kind of person that Americans could be proud of, because as America was getting more degenerate and, you know, crime, you know, juvenile delinquency, all these things, here was somebody, you know, who was about as tried-and-true, rock-ribbed, you know, old-fashioned, traditional American as you could have. And people said that America still must be good if they could produce a Billy Graham. And so he got a lot of publicity there, and that's what touched off the next thing, and that was that the publisher, editor of Lifetime, was Henry R. Luce, who himself was a very devoted Christian. He had grown up from with missionary parents in China. He's what we call a China kid. There are a lot of these. I'm trying to think of some other famous people. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Some people in the State Department were China kids. But Luce was a very devoted layperson, and he was also a cold warrior and believed we've got to have build up spiritual resources to resist communism. And so he, starting in, I think it was the November, 15th or 16th issue of Life, gave Graham full treatment. And Graham had been getting, as I say, virtually nowhere on a national or even regional scale before. Suddenly, overnight, you know, you get national publicity from Hearst and from Time and Life. And from that time on, it just took off. It just went straight to the top. Within 2 years, let's see, that was 50, then Eisenhower became president in 52, and he was even invited, he was invited to the White House by Truman, the president beforehand. Once you get invited there, you're moving right along. But I don't mean to be sarcastic. Graham would answer the charges that he, plays to the media by saying, whatever it takes to get the message, you know, out in front of the people is what, you know, what I'll do.